Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Good morning, afternoon, evening. We have reached the end of another week. I am Emily Jane Fox here with my co-host, Joe Hagan. Hi, Joe.
I'm exhausted.
We did it. Barely.
Yeah.
Why are you so tired? What happened this week that could have made you so tired?
The news intake. Yeah, the news intake. It's been like the fire hose to the face all week long with hurricanes, social unrest, propaganda, lies, conspiracies. You know, I, like a lot of people, you get to where you're on Twitter, your social media, you're looking at your news, and it becomes like a feedback loop of horror, and then you become numb, and you just need somebody to slap you in the face and remind you that this isn't all your life. I'm very depressed after this week.
Well, I'm here to slap you in the face.
I remember last week I was like, I'm optimistic. This week was like the battering ram that sort of like crushed the tin can.
That was by design, though. Like, yeah, the Democrats' message during the DNC was a moment of hope and a way to uplift you. And the message of the Republican National Convention is the exact opposite. It is, they're coming for you. In your streets, white people. The Law and Order Party is here to save you from the social movements that are pushing progress in our streets. The coronavirus doesn't exist in this world. President Trump has done a remarkable job of pulling our country out of a pandemic, despite all evidence to the contrary. And our president is a man who is empathetic, kind, and father of the year, every year. That's the message that we've gotten this week. It's not uplifting. It is deeply delusional. But I hear you when you say that you wanted a slap in the face, and I'm going to give you one.
Thank you.
I am 3 hours behind you. So I woke up this morning I always wake up this morning sort of already through the day. It was 6 o'clock, which is 9 o'clock on the East Coast. And Jared Kushner, the Fresh Prince of Colorama, had already done a series of interviews on Thursday morning. And what he said was he was going to call LeBron James today.
Yeah, I saw that.
Now, the NBA's two teams in the NBA decided to, in protest, say that we are not going to play our games, which is a decision that on Wednesday night when they made the decision was across the board lauded and widely praised as a real inflection point. And you don't have to care about sports to care about that story. And it has ramifications that are widespread and really important. And I want to go into all of that in the interview that you and I do. But Jared Kushner said, I'm going to call LeBron James, and I want to make this not an emotional thing, but I want to make this a practical conversation where we can talk about actual concrete solutions rather than the emotional argument that they're trying to make. And it's really nice that the NBA players have the ability to not go to work for one day. They're very fortunate, but we really need to solve this problem in a concrete way, which obviously has never been. There's never been a more ironic statement than Jared Kushner sort of digging people for not having to work.
Right.
Because Jared Kushner's never had to work a day in his life. And it reminded me of a comment that Jared made in his first interview when he after he took off office. That's exactly how it feels. After he took his role in the West Wing. And in the interview, it was with the Washington Post, and I believe it was like 2 months into the administration. And Jared Kushner referred to the American people as his customers. And I remember reading it and being like, no, no, no. We're not his customers. We're his bosses. That's not how this works. First of all, America is not a corporation. It's a country. And second of all, you have the power dynamics completely wrong. And part of it is because he's never had a boss who is not related to him either by blood or by marriage. So he doesn't truly understand what it's like to be responsible to anyone who's not related to him. But part of it is just a fundamental lack of empathy and a knee-jerk reaction to McKinseyize every problem that he sees rather than actually feel what people could be feeling. And this comment this morning struck me as so distinctly Jared. And Jared Kushner believes that he's going to be the one to de-escalate the social movement that we've been living through and problem solve like a fucking consultant. It was the most deranged read of the moment that we need Jared Kushner to sweep in and be the one to have a hard conversation with LeBron James that's going to deeply hit and solve the racial injustice in our country. It was such a wild way to see the world. I had to mention it before we get into the rest of the conversation.
Wouldn't you love to be in on that phone call? Did you see?
No, I wouldn't. I don't want that phone call to happen.
He was like, he's incredibly angry and passionate, as he should be. He was on all caps on Twitter yesterday, and he's actually doing something for the country. He started a voting initiative, LeBron James did, you know, to get black people to the polls and to protect their right to vote. And meanwhile, the lack of empathy that you're talking about is almost the only real core defining principle of the Trump campaign. It's to not have empathy. It is to not connect people together. It is to divide, right? And his sort of like bloodless, and I'm talking about Jared, this sort of bloodless, you know, wooden toy that wishes he was a boy is just, he's a non-entity in the conversation of America. He's just a factotum with, you know, ambition. I mean, there's nothing else there, right? We've discussed this in the past. He's infuriating. Let's talk about the Trump family as they have been seen this week at the RNC convention. You are our resident expert in some of the family dynamics of the Trump family.
I've taken a bullet for all of us.
Thank you for doing that. You really have. It's a service. It's a public service. But, you know, they were the faces of this kind of propaganda operation that we saw this week. I mean, the moments after any of these convention nights has just been one giant fact check, right? That is almost mind-blowing in the amount of lies and distortions coming out. But tell me what you saw.
Okay. I feel like I have PTSD from all of my reporting on these people, but I'm going to bring it to you here because that's what we do here at Inside the Hive. So yeah.
Explore your feelings.
A couple of things. When I was reporting my book about the Trump kids, a bunch of people told me at the time that Donald Trump, before he was President Trump, barely knew who Lara Trump was, his daughter-in-law who's married to Eric, until the campaign, because he started watching her on Fox News. Like, he wouldn't necessarily even remember her name all the time, but when he started seeing her on Fox News and how telegenic she is and how effective she was as a surrogate for him in that medium, he actually started realizing that she was part of his family and married to his youngest or his second youngest son. And that nugget of reporting has come back to me a bunch of times as I've watched the RNC this week, because you saw his adult children use this moment to sort of like prove their love to their father. Yeah. And It's such a bizarre thing, particularly as you watched the Biden family speak about their grandfather. The Biden family speaking about their grandfather and their father last week felt like an actual family where they were recounting what it's like to have Joe Biden as their father and as their grandfather. The grandchildren were talking about what kind of ice cream he likes and how he eats ice cream out of the freezer and how he calls them almost every day. And it felt like how I would speak about my grandparents probably. And the Trump family recalled no such memories of
right.
family togetherness. And that's largely because there was not a lot of family togetherness. But it also speaks to the kind of man that Donald Trump wants, that Donald Trump is, and the kind of children that he wants. He wants children who will be loyal foot soldiers to him, who will praise him, who will speak directly to him and say, "Daddy, I love you. You're the best father. You're the best president in the world." That's just, it's not how you speak to your parents. It's not how you show them that you love them, but it felt like the exact way that that family operates is that they need to bow down to their king, and they are constantly in fear that he will leave them if he doesn't. I mean, so much of their psychology has to do with the fact that, at least for the three eldest children, that their father did leave them for another woman when they were 12, 9, and 6, or whatever the ages were, something like that. And in different ways, that's manifested for them as adults. But primarily, it has been, I think, a feeling that if they are not on their father's train, that he will leave them behind. And that sort of constant parental fear that they will be abandoned by their parent has guided a lot of their adult decisions. And to see that play out on national television on such a great stage just felt really sad to me. And there was a lot of talk about Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is Don Jr.'s girlfriend, and about Don Jr. and his eyes. And it's a funny thing, when the first night of the Republican National Convention, the term that is trending is cocaine or cocaine eyes. I mean, say what you will, I have no idea what happened before. I've tried to report it out. No one wants to talk to me about it. but it just is not a good look. It's funny. People also talk about this power struggle within the family of who's going to be the heir of the Republican Party. Is it going to be Don Jr., who's become this sort of populist, hunting, get your gun voice in the Republican Party, or Ivanka Trump, who's become princess of the universe in her own mind? And the way I know it from my reporting is there's actually not a power struggle between the two of them. They kind of don't really interact that much. They just serve very different purposes. I don't believe that Ivanka Trump wants to be president. I think she wants to be princess. And I think Don Jr. has actual political ambitions. I think that if Ivanka Trump, if you were to tell her tomorrow that she could be head of like the World Bank or the IMF or a UN ambassador who could go on stage with Queen Maxima of the Netherlands, like that's what she wants, right? I don't think she like actually wants to be in the White House grinding it out every day. Don Jr. wants that. So I don't actually think that there's this power struggle between the siblings. I think they just want, they're on very different tracks. But
right. Well, you know, it's interesting what you're saying there. I see Don Jr. has got this ambition and he likes to be a speaker and a media figure. What he lacks that Donald Trump has that defines everything that you're talking about is the essential narcissism. I mean, the reason that the kids are all like this is because he's a narcissist and he sees everybody around him as an extension of himself. And to the degree that they benefit and underline and italicize his narcissistic tendencies is the degree to which he likes them, quote unquote, right? Everybody serves a use. They do not have any sort of, and that goes for the American people we're seeing. That goes for, you know, if you're not a voter, if you're not compelled by his celebrity and his bellicose propaganda, then he has no interest in you. Okay. That's the, you know, the psychology of this narcissism is defining everything. That's why I don't see Don Jr. He could take up all the kind of like whatever the platform is of the Trump Republican Party at this point. It's hard, even hard to know, right? It's just like primary colored, you know, brittle iconography of flags and eagles and, you know, vaguely something about taxes in China, but no, you know, but we don't actually do anything about it. And when we do cut taxes, it doesn't actually have any benefit for the people on the ground that are actually, you know, supposedly his working class base. It's all just a fraud. And I don't think it's a fraud that Don Jr. will ever be able to prop up on his own, is my read on it.
Mm.
I really do think that once Trump is seen to have been a loser, the loser that he's desperate not to be, that a lot of the fiction that we've seen this week will not be supportable any longer, because it's a faith-based concept of this self-propelling celebrity winner thing. You know, it's about power. And once the power is gone, once he's a loser, I think a lot of these other people are going to fall down on their face and not be able to take up the mantle. Maybe that's being optimistic. You know me. But anyway, so
I'm going to come in as a dark cloud, and I'm really sorry. I don't want to crush you, but I'm going to crush
please
you.
Please do. Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
I'm already crushed.
I am scared he's not going to be a loser. I feel like, but until May of this year, I was like, I would say 100% sure he was going to win re-election. Between May and Monday of this week, I felt like, oh, maybe Joe Biden's going to do this. It feels crazy to think about re-electing President Trump right now. And now, today, as I talk to you, I am worried that this is going to be so much closer than you think.
Right.
Like, this is going to be really close. And I genuinely don't know which way this is going to go. No one does. There are people who will tell you that they do. And maybe they do. I really don't know how this is going to end up. But I do have a really strong feeling that this is going to be much closer than you want it to be. That it's going to be much closer than the polls tell you it's going to be. And there is a real part of this country that wants to reelect this president. And we don't hear from them. We talked about this last week. We don't hear from them because most reporters are not there, and because people don't trust the polls, and because people are embarrassed to admit that they would want to vote for this president again. But it's happening. And to ignore it is to make the same mistake that people made in 2016. And so I would just say it's real, that we can't forget that just because people personally support Joe Biden and can't imagine who would vote for Donald Trump, that there aren't people who would vote for him.
Well, and I agree with you, and I do think it will be a nail biter. There's no getting around it. You know, that's how it's worked for the last many election cycles. I mean, even when it was Romney versus Obama, people were biting their nails up to the last minute. It wasn't clear. It's not going to be that clear. But and by the way, this morning, Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine tweeted out that support for Black Lives Matter in Wisconsin has gone from plus 25 to plus zero, that it had evaporated. And, you know, we're watching what's going on in Kenosha this week. All kinds of horrible violence. There's unrest. And that's happening simultaneously to this Republican National Convention, where they're saying this is Joe Biden's America. It's absurd on its face. You know,
tell us why that's absurd.
Because it's sort of as the Times put it today, you know, the GOP is promising to or it's saying we're going to fix all of this. But oh, by the way, there's this problem. You're actually in charge right now. And, you know, the animating anger and unrest is connected to Donald Trump's presidency.
Of course.
He has inflamed this divide. He has consciously ignored the cries of people who were complaining about, you know, police brutality and these senseless murders. So he's inflaming it and then saying that he's going to be the solution to it. Now, you know, the degree to which, and this is where it's up to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to counter-program that. You know, I'm sitting here today, and I was thinking when I was reading this about support for BLM in Wisconsin, you know, Kamala Harris needs to go to Kenosha. Mm. She needs to do a press conference and describe what is on the Biden-Harris platform that is going to fix this. Mm. And to show what leadership is, that you can go there and call for peace, ask questions, talk to people on the ground, connect, and make it better, right? And I don't see them doing that. I hope they do something like that. But there is a sense that we need them to step up and counter program.
Well, there's a leadership void, right? It's so clear. And the notion that Donald Trump is going to save us from Donald Trump's America is kind of a crazy thing.
It's asinine. Yeah.
But if you want to, you can step up and fill that leadership void. It's the gap is so wide that all you have to do is like just show up. And so there's an opportunity for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to just show up. I don't know if they will. They haven't risen to meet a moment like this outside of the DNC. I would be very curious to see if they take the opportunity to meet this moment, or if they want to let President Trump just seem like an empty, right, absent leader.
This is Inside the Hive.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS, just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, the other thing that stuck out to me from this convention is the blatant disregard for the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And nothing showed that to me more than everyone sitting in the Rose Garden, not distance and not wearing masks together. And the reason why that actually happened in practice is because the White House actually has quite a robust testing system, and then they were able to test all these people. Which I think is a terrible thing to rely on for two reasons. The first reason is either you are in the audience watching this on television and you know that the White House has a robust testing operation, and that's why they were able to sit so close together in the Rose Garden without masks. And you are angry about that fact. I am angry about that fact because I would love to have access to that kind of robust testing operation. I would love to be able to interview people in person. I would love to get on a plane to see my family. I would love to be able to go to the doctor's office without worrying if I'm going to get sick. And if rapid testing were easy and widespread and available to me, I would be able to do all of those things that are way more important than going to see a live speech that could have been recorded in a safe, distanced way. So either you know that the testing operation is there and you're mad about it, or you don't know that the testing operation is there and you think it's okay to behave in that manner where you're just with a huge group of people without masks, without knowing who's infected. And both of those things are incredibly maddening, incredibly dangerous, and just really hammer home how out of touch this RNC feels to most of Americans who are actually feeling the effects of a pandemic in a way that people in this convention
are not. Well, listen, this is the reason the Kenosha unrest simultaneously to the convention is complicated is that, you know, they want the coronavirus as a narrative to disappear this week. It's perfect for them to talk about law and order and we had Larry Kudlow, you know, at the convention talking about the coronavirus in past tense this week, right? It's all part of a narrative to make it look like it's in the rear view. It's not in the present. You don't have to worry about it. We're pretending it doesn't exist. We're fist bumping after our speeches. You know, this is like exactly, you know, in many ways, people have been asking, well, are they going to address this unrest? Are they going in many ways, this what's going on in Wisconsin has served, you know, their narrative interests to make it all disappear.
Of course. I mean, but here's the reality. You can't disappear something that is keeping your children home from school. You can't disappear something that has closed the factory that you work in or the train that you ride to work on or the grocery store that's now requiring you to wait outside for 45 minutes because there are only 20 people allowed in the store at the same time. Like, you can't just pretend this doesn't happen because for everyone in this country, this is real and the effects are present in our hourly comings and goings. It's not like for a large part of this country, particularly white people in this country, you could tune out the social unrest, right? Like unless you are participating in a protest or they're happening outside of your window or they are happening in your streets, which for most people they're not right now, then you can tune that out. And so to focus on something that is so not immediate when there's something that is so immediate just feels like, don't believe your eyes and ears and experiences. Believe this crazy delusional world that we're presenting you right here that has no connection to your life. And
so there's my question for you. Do you think this was an effective convention? I mean, we can't know whether there'll be a bounce. You know, the ratings are roughly in parity with the DNC's. It's not like that's a real measure of anything, you know. But do you think that it's doing anything other than just giving comfort to the base?
No. But I also think that conventions are dumb. And most people in this world do not watch them. The vast majority of this country is not watching either of these conventions. There will be a slight bounce like there was for Biden-Harris last week. And then those bounces get zeroed out until there's a debate, and then they get zeroed out until there's another debate. And so these moments don't actually matter. There are a lot of money. There are a lot of Twitter chatter. There are a lot of pomp and circumstances for something that actually has no bearing on what happens at the polls in November. I think that this will be, I mean, I think that the era of in-person conventions is definitely over. I don't know that there will be a convention like this even digitally ever again. It's just stupid. It just feels like there's really no net outcome for the actual campaign and process of democracy. So even if this message is effective for his base, which maybe it is, it does nothing to convert new voters, I don't think, because most people aren't watching it.
Yeah. Well, they're getting the you know, short clips after the fact. I mean, and frankly, you know, a lot of us are, because it's, as has been mentioned many times this week, it's painful to watch these things.
Yep.
It's horrible to watch Mike Pence, this sort of like bloodless whitewasher, just sit up there and spout these earnest lies with these flags behind him is nauseating, frankly. And so, you know, who's watching this and it feels good to them, right? It can only be the culty true believers.
But those true believers elected a president last time around. And so,
right, by 70,000 votes in these certain states. I mean, that's why Wisconsin and these states that we need to be paying attention to right now are, you know, they're at the center of the conversation in a way that could break bad for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris if they don't address it and show leadership, because it's so easy for the Trump administration to not do anything and just watch it unfold and scream law and order the whole time, right? And, you know, trot out this couple from Missouri, the Tweedledum and Tweedledee, like with their, you know, these idiot suburbanites with their rifles. I mean, the fact that they rolled them out, that just shows they put them in the convention. It just shows that they're so brazen, right? And they don't have to do anything. All they have to do is make media noise and outrage the media and trigger everybody. And that's their effort.
It works. You're triggered. And also, I mean, Joe, you were triggered by it and it worked. And my issue with that was not like, of course they did that. That's straight out of their playbook. And those people speak to other people in this space. And so I totally understand why they were there. The problem that I had with it as a political tool was that they had this couple in a very fancy wood paneled room in like a suit and a dressy outfit on the woman. And it just felt like, if you're going to try and push this populist message of like, don't take our guns, don't make them look like they're going to the country club. That just optically felt like the wrong choice there.
Well, but this goes back to something you hear now and then, which is that, and it's an important point, we often think of the white working class as the core of the Trump support. But in fact, it's them.
Yep.
You know, it's a much wealthier suburban group who are supporting him. And, you know, you'd think that this would be an educated class that could discern fact from fiction. But, you know, people believe what they want to believe.
This is Inside the Hive.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's talk for a moment about how Vanity Fair magazine is addressing what's going on today. Because you and I are talking about it for this podcast and keeping people informed about what's going on and giving them different perspectives. But the magazine this month has produced really what I think will be a historic issue of Vanity Fair that people will look back on. It's a milestone issue. It is one that was guest edited by Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author and critic and journalist, addressing the Black Lives Matter movement, everything that's happened this summer in the wake of the George Floyd protests, what the ramifications of it are. And it's really a kind of an incredibly gorgeous issue.
There's a gorgeous, gorgeous portrait of Breonna Taylor on the cover. It really feels like such an important marker of the moment that we're in. And I could not agree with you more that it feels historic and it feels timeless and it feels like such a statement. And I feel very proud to work at Vanity Fair always, but I feel particularly proud this week. As you said, it was guest edited by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and you got to talk to him. I guess he's technically our boss for the week.
Yes, he was our temporary boss.
So you got to talk to the boss and tell us a little bit about what you guys got to talk about.
You know, this is a great time for this issue to have arrived because it really underlines what we should be thinking about when we're looking at what's going on in Kenosha and around the country and the reaction to it, LeBron James, you know, what's happening with the NBA, you know, a reminder that even in this news cycle world, the Trump news cycle world, in which last week, it seems like 5 years ago already, things changed so quickly, right? But everything that happened this summer with the George Floyd protests is an ongoing story. It is a story that is not going anywhere, and it has incredible political power that could change the dynamics of this country politically one way or the other. And at the core of it is a vision of what justice means in this country, and what is the identity of this country, and what does it mean that everybody, that you know, that we live in a society of equality. So this issue is a kind of a celebration and a memorialization of these ideas and these values. And it's really kind of got all this kind of beautiful, groundbreaking journalism in it. There's an oral history of the days, first days of the protests, with all kinds of amazing voices in it. I just want to point out, as before we segue into this conversation I had with Ta-Nehisi, he was assigned by Vanity Fair to go to Louisville, Kentucky, in the wake, you know, when there were protests around the Breonna Taylor killing by police officers there. And he didn't know what was going to come out of his reporting, but he ended up meeting her mother and sitting down with her and hearing her voice, decided and realized that the piece that he had to write could not be told any better than just her voice. Mm. And he does a kind of, you know, as told to oral history of her life and with her daughter, and humanizes her in a way that, you know, I read it yesterday before I was going to interview him, and I haven't cried reading a piece of journalism in a while, but I did, and it was involuntary, and I was even surprised by it, but it was really, really powerful. And it just was yet again a reminder of what great journalism can do, why what we're doing can be important, and why, you know, when two people like Radhika Jones and Ta-Nehisi Coates come together to, with a big staff like the one we have, and bring in, you know, new writers and new thoughts, and with a kind of mission, that great things can happen. And that's something we can think about more largely politically right now.
I couldn't agree more. You and I talked about this yesterday, actually, and I think we think about this all the time, but oftentimes when you're set out to do a profile, you'll hear someone who you're writing about and you'll say, oh, this person can talk about themselves way better than I could talk about them, but you have to just try because that's the job. And you are probably the only one who knows that they're better at what they're doing than you will be in capturing them. And so only you are slightly disappointed when you know that it's not quite as good as it would have been if you just kept something in their words. And I think it's a real bold choice to have kept this in her words, but I think it was 100% the right choice. And particularly in this moment when I think it's just so important to have everyone speak for themselves and let the power of their own words be heard, and the different perspectives on what we're seeing is just so incredibly valuable to hear people in their own voices and words. I think that that is something that we should carry through into the rest of this election cycle. It's like we should hear people who we don't normally hear in their own words, whether that is BIPOC people who we have not given the platforms to before, whether that is turning over a magazine to a different voice, whether that is listening to Trump voters in the middle of the country and actually hearing what they have to say and why they're supporting the president for the second time or newly supporting him. And I think that we just have to be more open to hearing people in their own experiences and getting uncomfortable and getting into other people's heads and feeling at least sympathy for people, if not empathy. And that's just a message that I would like to carry through into the rest of this election season and going beyond that.
That was really beautifully put. And I think the way in which journalism can be empathetic is something we don't talk about enough. And that's something that the core vision of, I think, what Tana Hasi Coates brought to Vanity Fair for this special issue is exactly that, empathy and journalism. So let's listen now to my conversation with him, which for you journalism nerds is also going to be nice to hear too, because we get into the sausage making of making a magazine. So let's listen now. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome to Inside the Hive. We're very proud to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today about the September issue of Vanity Fair, which you guest edited. Now, a lot of people don't know exactly what that means, and it can mean different things, but that means basically you took over the driver's seat and you had your way with the machinery behind Vanity Fair, this great American magazine. Tell me, like, how this came together. What was the genesis of you coming into this issue?
You know, the better way I would actually think about it is, like, if I don't know if you remember this, but back in the day, when you got your driving permit, you were in the driver's seat, but the person that was teaching you how to drive had a steering wheel on their side too, and they could take control whenever they needed to.
Was that Radhika Jones?
And that was Radhika.
Yeah. I love that image.
So that was Radhika. You know, it came about because we had been talking about another story that did not quite come together. And we were just trying to figure out what we should do, you know? Yeah. And I think I was actually in conversation with Claire. And Claire was like, well, what do you think about the idea of guest editing? And that may have come from Radhika originally. I'm not sure.
Claire Howorth, who's one of the editors at Vanity Fair.
Exactly. Right. And I mean, who would not want to guest edit Vanity Fair?
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, I've been, you know, reading the magazine at least for as long as, you know, a period of time, and I've, you know, been in journalism. So, you know, almost 25 years now.
Yeah.
You know, I came up in a way where that was what we all ascribed to. This was a different era in the 90s in terms of where magazines were,
right?
Both as products and just, you know, financially and everything.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, for me, like the fulfillment of a dream. I could never imagine, you know, being able to do that.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a interesting time for you to have come into the mix. You know, Radhika Jones has obviously sort of shifted the kind of focus and tone of the magazine over the last year to kind of be more diverse into who was going to be on the cover and in the magazine. And, you know, we're in this interesting, you know, inflection point. That's a word that's getting thrown around a lot nowadays. And we hope it's a bigger one in November. But, you know, the inflection point at hand was the George Floyd murder and protests and the Black Lives Matter protests starting in May that went into June and beyond. Tell me, like, you know, when you're beginning to think about taking over a whole magazine, you've got all kinds of possibilities. And in many ways, this issue breaks many molds and does a lot of kind of beautiful old-fashioned magazine things that had not been in vogue in Vanity Fair recently, like poetry. There's an oral history. The centerpiece of the thing is this beautiful oral history of the protest movement and how, you know, almost day by day what happened. You know, did Radhika basically, it seems like she gave you a lot of freedom that to kind of break, you know, the mold a little bit.
You know, she did, but, you know, I gotta, and this is not false modesty. Like, I think I need to be clear here. I think both Radhika and Claire, when we talked about this, and my editor, Chris Jackson, I think they were looking for something that would do exactly that because, you know, this is the time.
Yeah.
There's a lot in this issue that I can't even claim, you know, credit for. The poetry that you're talking about is kind of this epic poem by Kiese Layman. I mean, this was, you know, Claire, you know, was already in contact with him for writing for the magazine. Jesmyn, you know, who has just a wonderful, wonderful piece for the magazine, already had a relationship with the magazine. You know, the whole front of the book stuff, which is just, you know, absolutely beautiful. You know, and so it really was it was very much a partnership. You know what I mean? It really, you know, was a situation where there were things that were already existing, or ideas that they were already existing, or even an idea of what this should be that was there that just, you know, really, really well matched.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's almost like the magazine and you and all the pieces met their moment, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. Just to give people who are listening to this an idea of what they might find, maybe they don't have the print magazine in their hand, although a lot of it's online. You know, there's this oral history I mentioned, which has got incredible voices in it from, you know, the mayor of Washington, D.C. to Jesse Jackson to Mitt Romney. This is, you know, a wide variety of voices are in there. But the cover is this incredibly beautiful painting by the painter Amy Sherald of Breonna Taylor, right? Mm-hmm. And you interviewed her mother. And there's a kind of as told to, you know, profile of her, told all in her own voice. And I guess I just say this, I read it this afternoon and I cried. I mean, I just was so incredible. I didn't expect that to happen either. I was like, I'm going to read this and let me get to the end of it and find out what I'll find out. But I was so moved by it. And I had learned that you originally, that wasn't your original idea to do it that way. Tell me about, you know, the experience of interviewing her and how you decided to kind of present it that way.
I mean, I went down to Louisville, to do the normal job of reporting. And I was frankly so moved by what I saw, you know, by the protests, that I was already, you know, just trying to figure out how would I capture this? And, you know, there's this thing when you've been writing in a certain way or kind of on a certain beat or saying certain things where I think regardless of whether it would be good for people to hear it again, I think you really, really risk saying things with the power that they need to be said if you keep doing them the same way. In other words, the moment it becomes easy for you and, you know, the moment that you're not challenging yourself and you feel like, you know what I mean, you're giving a speech that you've given 1,000 times, you're in trouble. And if you're in trouble, the reader's in trouble.
Yeah.
And so I just... I felt really strongly I had to do something different that really captured the energy of what I was seeing. And I never quite figured that out. But what I did do is I got the opportunity just, you know, the first time for only about 20 or 30 minutes to talk to Tamika Palmer, Breonna's mother.
That's right.
And actually, Joe, the first piece in that essay where she talks about finding out what happened to Breonna, or in that memoir, I should say, that was in that very first interview. And when I heard her narrate it, when I heard her talk about it, it was just so crystal clear to me and so alive and so just filled with like gripping detail that I just felt like I'm not going to write better than this woman is talking right now.
Right.
I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah.
And so my notion was, you know, it's like you find somebody doing it better than you, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can do it. You know, you try to tee them up and get them in. And so I called her probably like a week or two later after I, you know, read through the transcript. And I said, this is what I'm thinking. Would you consider doing this? Yeah. And she was totally up for it. And I, you know, as you can imagine, being interviewed 4 different times for an hour, it's not the most fun thing.
No.
You know, about your daughter who's been killed. That's not fun.
No, it could be. In this case, I can imagine it would be pretty emotionally grueling.
Yes. Yes.
But your decision to do that was so interesting. It reminded me, you know, I love oral history as a form. I think about Studs Terkel and some of the, you know, real pioneers of the form, but like it gave her agency to her voice and agency for her to the story. It gave it to her. And I could tell, you know, when well done, you know, they have an organic feel to them, even though I know they're shaped by, you know, to some degree by editors, but the details inside of it about her, you know, playing double dutch with her daughter you know, just the details of like how you had to be good at that and the things that you had to be aware of. It just brought you into the human details, the specific human details of this woman Right. You know, we hear her name all day long on Twitter or social media, and it has a kind of like symbolic, you know, meaning. But when you right. go into the details of this life of this woman who, you know, had a is into classic cars and knew how to ride a motorcycle, and
yes,
you know, it just breaks your heart on a new level. And in a way, you need your heart broken so you can understand what's
you
going
do.
On.
You know, you can look. I understand. You know, all of the sloganeering and everything. And, you know, you as a journalist, I know you're obviously very familiar with this. Our job is, at least in the kind of journalism we do, to make sure that people do not forget the human cost. When Tamika Palmer thinks about her daughter, she doesn't think about a slogan. She doesn't think about a bill that she wants passed in her name. She thinks about all of the little small things. She thinks about, you know, how she was part of a motorcycle club, and then she taught Tamika, and then she taught Brianna how to ride. She thinks about the cars that she loves. She thinks about her making chili. You know, she thinks about her singing, you know, at Christmas time, how she loved to have, you know, family gatherings. And you got to get that, all of that detail in there before somebody can really get the loss, because there's a danger of kind of just, you know, letting this stuff just disappear into a melange, you know, and you just don't, I mean, you just don't want that, you know, you just don't want that.
Right. Well, it's one of the most powerful pieces in this issue. And it's so, it really is in many ways, a classic piece of journalism. And I think that we'll be reading it for a long time. And the same goes for the oral history in here, you know, titled The Great Fire. You know, this is, I was involved in this, and John Homans, the late John Homans, had edited this. And just to throw this out there, to give him some, his due, you know, about a year and a half ago, he was like, we were talking about books that we were reading, and he suggested one that I read, and I did read it, and it was your book, The Beautiful Struggle. And he,
really?
Yeah, he had been a fan of that book and he thought it was really beautiful and told me to read it. And I did.
That's wild. That's a deep cut. That's my first book.
Yeah. Deep cut, man. And he basically like, you know, he cared about this piece and it was the last major piece that he worked on at this magazine before his untimely death a few weeks ago. But,
Joe, and I'm sorry for Vanity Fair's loss. I'm sorry for all of our losses as a, you know, as journalists. It's funny because the brief, you know, intersection that we had was my mentor, David Carr, who also passed. He was my first editor.
Right. I knew him. Knew him well. Yeah.
Yes. And I want to say John edited him at New York. You know, I might not quite have it right.
Yeah, he absolutely did. Yep.
Okay. That's what I thought. And so it was just something, even on, and I didn't know John was sick at that time, but to be on that Zoom, and to be there and you know, have that conversation with him about what the oral history would be, how, you know, what its shape was. You know, he had the whole vibe of an old school editor, man.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's such an honor that he, you know, for his last project to be something so meaningful, I think, well, brings me some sense of, you know, comfort about what his legacy is, because not only do I know he believed in it, but he did such a masterful job of putting it together with so much material. I mean, many interviews were done with some really fantastic people and who had amazing insights. I mean, any one of these transcripts, by the way, you know, I'm thinking now of Sherrilyn Ifill of the Legal Defense Fund, just an incredibly brilliant, eloquent person. And, you know, her transcript by itself could have been an interview, but you know, he took all of these pieces and put them together. And I remember, in the creation of this, he had a meeting with you and they talked about, let's talk about the timeline. It's going to be from May 25th to around June 5th. I think it was, you know, from the time of George Floyd's death until they painted Black Lives Matters on the streets in Washington. And, it was a kind of, you had written up, or somebody had written based on your guidance, like what the issues that you wanted to kind of focus on. And I kept thinking as I was going through it, I wonder what Ta-Nehisi's own experience was of these times. I mean, what was your first, when did the George Floyd event come across your transom and where were you and how did that strike you?
You know, before we get to that, I'd like to say one of the best things about that oral history is that, like, we got to police officers, like, we really had a well-rounded, you know, picture.
Yeah.
You know, because I think when you're doing the history, you need that. You know what I mean? Even if, you know, whatever my politics are, you know, me not necessarily being in sympathy with everyone. I mean, one of the things I learned very early on as a reporter is, you talk to people you disagree with, even when you're going to say you're going to disagree with them.
Yeah.
And so even if that wasn't the energy of the issue, I just thought, you know, we had a very, very well-rounded picture in that oral history. So I thank you guys. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, I think I found out, like everybody else, you know, I saw, you know, watching on TV. As I say, you know, in the publisher's letter, I never watched the whole video.
Right.
But there was a moment when it occurred to me that this was going to be big, and that was, there was a day, maybe three or four, and we have this in the oral history, maybe three or four days after George Floyd had been killed, and they hold this big press conference, and it looks like they're going to do something, like they're going to announce charges or something like that, but they don't, and everybody's on edge, and they just say, you know, can we have, you know, we're pleading for more patience, and I was watching that thinking, you guys don't realize you're out of time.
Yeah.
Like you're asking for something that you don't have. And then the DA at the time, the guy who was prosecuting the case,
right,
comes up and he says, you know, listen, there's some evidence that this might have been justified. And I watched that. I said, listen, if it's legal to torture somebody to death on a public street, if there are reasons to justify that, then there's no law. There's no law at all.
Right.
You know,
that's right.
I don't care if the guy's a serial killer. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to think of what would justify the state doing that, and I just can't think of anything. And then that night they burnt down a precinct.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it spread. So.
Yeah, well, that was a real, and that moment came up in several of my conversations, as being, you know, again, that was a turning point. It was unbelievable, and it spoke to so much of the history leading up to this moment. You know, how many times have people heard that before as a, you know, a kind of to soften the public image of what happened so that the police department can, you know, get off the hook, right? And
right.
So just the rage there that was under the surface of this, and you had like the Ahmaud Arbery thing having happened only 2 months prior. I mean, there was just so much raw stuff. I mean, but I have to say, I mean, one of the things that I kept talking about with people in the oral history was, you know, when I first saw it, I don't think I watched the whole thing at first. And, you know, you saw clips of it across social media, but I thought, well, this is horrible. And probably in 2 weeks, it'll disappear out of the headlines, right? You just have that kind of depressed thought. And it didn't happen this time. And of course, what unfolded has become this political force in the country that we're dealing with up to the minute that you and I are talking.
Yeah.
You know, we've got what's going on in Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's like, you know, happening again. But I wanted to sort of ask you about that in relation to what we're seeing, you know, on the political level. You know, politics is a very kind of like imperfect expression of what is going on the street level and the emotions that you and I have been talking about. But I'm just curious, like, you know, are you comfortable talking a little bit about what your politics have been up to this point? Like, we had a Democratic nominating you know, process, right, in the spring. Some people were into the Bernie side and some people were more centrist, you know, blah, blah, blah. But like, what's been your own kind of experience of this presidential election?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my politics are that hard to guess. You know, I was somewhere between Bernie and Warren, you know, during the primary. And you know, some of that comes through, you know, in the letter. I think in this moment, you know, and again, this is what I argue, that I think there's a lot of attention paid to whether the young people who are out in the street are going to vote.
Right.
Obviously, I think voting is really important. I think without whatever, you know, progress that, you know, we hope for going forward, without Trump being removed, I don't think it's going to be possible. You know, the fight, in other words, the fight that we want to have, I don't think it's possible. You know, like Trump being removed is a prerequisite to that. I mean that in the most direct and literal sense.
Sure.
You know, whatever you think of Joe Biden, whatever you think of Kamala Harris, it's clear that if you had a different attorney general, even what we're seeing in Kenosha right now would be going differently.
Yep.
There's a big difference between what we're seeing right now from the federal government and, say, Eric Holder going down to Ferguson. Yeah. And commissioning a report that ultimately, you know, showed that the police department was, you know, basically using the black community as a source of, you know, a kind of municipal slush fund through, you know, these fines and these arrests and that sort of thing.
Right.
So you can't even get there, you know what I mean,
right,
without the vote. But having said that, you know, I think it's really, really important that people regard voting as the beginning,
right,
and not the end of their politics.
That's right.
You know, I think that's really, really important. And so that's probably where I am right now. That's one of the reasons why I've been very, you know, heartened to see so many people, you know, out in the streets not letting this die.
Yeah.
This is Inside the Hive.
Well, I have to say that the my mind, I had such intense cognitive dissonance this week watching the Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron speaking at the Trump convention.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the guy who's supposed to be investigating the Breonna Taylor murder.
Yeah.
And he's out here, and it's very fascinating. I mean, he's trying to make a case that we've heard before, you know, that, you know, him being a Trump Republican is an expression of his own independence, right? That there's diversity,
right,
of thought in the black community.
Right.
And, you know, but, right? What, I mean, when you see that from the point of view of an African-American man who's sympathetic to Black Lives Matter, and you're trying to aim a light on it and understand it, what goes through your mind when you are watching him?
I wish I could tell you I was surprised.
Yeah.
I wish I could tell you I was surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I, you know, as much as, and I've said this before, and I really, really hate saying this, but as much as I applaud the protest movement, as much as I applaud the courage of Breonna's mother, I would be shocked if the powers that be hold those officers responsible.
Right.
I'd be surprised. I'd be really, really, really surprised.
Yeah. I guess I have been... And maybe it's just like a parlor game in my mind, but I'm trying to put myself into the head of Daniel Cameron. Like, it's Shakespearean, right? I mean,
yeah.
What? How could he look at this and then get on a stage to defend and advocate for Donald Trump, whose racial, you know, animus is transparent and explicit?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I am just have been trying to wrap my mind around it, and I don't know, you know, it's in some ways in this current, you know, world that we're living in, I don't feel like I have the credibility to criticize him. You know, I'm like, who am I to say, right? If he says there's, you know, he's trying to say, I am also black. And Joe Biden said, you know, if you vote for Biden, quote, you ain't black. Right. So that
right.
was a gaffe. Right.
Right.
And yet, you know, is Daniel Cameron purely a cynic?
I don't know. I've giving up psychoanalyzing.
I know. Well, I started to get fascinated with the idea because of, did you see the Spike Lee, you know, movie about the Vietnam guys?
The Five Bloods. I haven't seen it yet.
No. Oh, okay. Well, it's really, I mean, it's flawed in many ways, but it's so fascinating because the most compelling character in it is a black Trump voter.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's fascinating because this on the in the most blunt level, Trump is, you know, people will say that that Tim Scott and Daniel Cameron are like cover for him, right?
Uh-huh.
They're inoculating him against seeming like a pure white party, right? And he's making these overtures. It's all theater, right?
Right.
And so I've just been trying to, because that's been happening this week, it's been on my mind and it's been like a thorn in my brain trying to process it, you know. And maybe it's something that you consider just, you know, not worth analyzing, just sort of curious.
Like, no, I don't. I don't. That's not it. I'm about where you are, though. I don't quite understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how you read what happened to Breonna Taylor, and you're okay with that.
Yeah.
It just, and I don't know how you don't connect that to the politics, you know, of
exactly.
the president.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't get it. I don't get it.
And so, what do you hope that the impact of this issue of Vanity Fair that you just created, helped create?
That's a great question.
Will be, you know, I mean, I could, you know, pontificate that from what I hope it will be from my own point of view. But like, you know, as the person who's sort of helped germinate this, I mean, what do you hope it will be in the larger scope of things?
Yeah. What myself and Radhika talked about early on was, as well as Claire and as well as Chris, was the idea that whatever we did, it should be something that when people want to understand what was happening in 2020, they go back and look at this. That was the main thing. I mean, I think bearing witness.
Right.
I mean, this is our greatest power. You know, we don't really have the ability to go out and directly lobby or, you know, go out and really march. Like, that's not really what journalists do, but they make sure that the country doesn't forget if they're doing it right.
Yeah.
If they're doing it right. You know what I mean? They bear witness to what was actually happening, you know, for those who, you know, later on hope to make a better world. And so in my mind, this was very, very future looking.
Yeah.
I wanted folks to feel like this was not just another, you know, with all due respect to Vanity Fair, given that we were living in inordinate times, I really, really wanted this to stand out, you know, in a particular way. And I think Radhika did too.
Yeah. Well, just yesterday, we were taping, you know, for listeners, we're taping on Wednesday, August 26th. And just yesterday, Kamala Harris, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, tweeted out the cover. And what a, you know, which is huge, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of a real, you know, interesting, a breakthrough image, you know, helped this image really break through in a way. And God,
I hope she reads the article on police abolition.
Yeah. Yeah.
She reads it.
And just, you know, in the article, I mean, in the magazine, there's also a conversation with Amy Sherald, who painted the cover image. People may know previously she had painted Michelle Obama. I think that I saw that painting in Washington. It's a gorgeous painting. So, like, you know, there's so much special about this issue. I think that it is something that we will definitely look back on as a document of these times. And I feel that you really brought creativity and kind of intellectual and, you know, just a lot of like soul to the magazine in what you helped do here. And I'm very grateful for having to have been a participant in this issue. So Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much for coming on Inside the Hive. And do you have any last thoughts that you want to telegraph about this issue that you think?
No, I would just say, you know, I'm going to use you as a stand-in. I want to thank the whole staff. And I want to thank you, Joe. That the oral history is just tremendous. I hope everybody reads it. Everybody was creative, professional, agile. We did this without, you know, in these times as they demand, with everybody at distance. And it was just a tremendous experience. It was just a tremendous, the creating it was just a tremendous, I mean, it was no harder than it had to be. You know, I mean, think doing things like this are hard, but it was no harder than it had to be. And I just, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we're glad to have had you here and as a coworker for this special issue. And if you're listening, please seek out this, you know, subscribe to Vanity Fair and you can get it in the mail. Then you don't have to go out with your mask if you don't want to. Or look online because it's been beautifully presented at vanityfair.com. Thank you again, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And we will hopefully bring you back here at a later date and hopefully in more optimistic times.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, man.
Thank you to my co-host, Joe Hagan. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to listen and subscribe to other great Inside the Hive episodes. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And of course, thanks to my sponsors. Please support them any way you would support this podcast. We will see you next week.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.